This week on Out of the Air features animator, illustrator, director, writer, producer Scott Krishnasava discussing his new book, Becoming an Artist. Next, local playwright Zachary Mark, whose play Second Glance made its premiere in March under the direction of Steve Scott. Our spotlights on Lakeshore Public Media's special screen and discussion of PBS The American Revolution on April 22nd at Valpo University.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, WVLP, 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is heard every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org. and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Also heard on Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at WVLP.org. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Media. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. We'd like to welcome to Art on the Air Spotlight, Elizabeth Gingrich. She's a professor of law in the Business School at Valparaiso University, vice chair of Lakeshore Public Media Board of Directors, and also part of the presenting of the American Revolution on April 22nd at Valparaiso University. Welcome to Art on the Air Spotlight.
Currently preparing for the April 22nd event at Valparaiso University Hari Union in the triple ballrooms upstairs. This is from 3 to 5 p.m. This will show segments of the American Revolution, Ken Burns's probably magnum opus, and released at a time that could not be more formidable, in the 250th celebration of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. We will show segments. We will have facilitators. Those will involve James Old, who's chair of the Department of Political Science at Valparaiso University, Natalie Krivas, who is a professor of English. She's also a dual native Canada, especially, well, Nova Scotia, and the United States. And so she comes to this with a unique perspective in terms of the involvement of Canada in the American Revolution. Then we've got Anton Lewis, who teaches business at Governor State University in Illinois. He is a dual resident and a dual citizen of the UK and the US. So he's got an incredible British accent, and there's nobody better to introduce some of these battle scenes. And so then there's Richard Sevier, who's Dean of Humanities at Purdue Northwest. So we've got quite a lineup. And Meg was head of Indiana Humanities, a program director, and of course, Nancy Clifford and Larry here from Lakeshore Public Media. So 2-hour affair, again, 3 to 5 p.m. on April the 22nd, Triple Ballroom, Hari Union, VU. It is free. We always ask for donations for Lakeshore, but it is free. But you need to reserve your place or places. And just contact me directly, elizabeth.gingrich, and Gingrich is spelled G-I-N-G-E-R-I-C-H at valpo.edu for your reservation. There'll be light refreshments throughout, too.
Let's talk about, we're showing segments during this, so talk about the actual structure of the event itself.
Sure. Well, what's going to happen with the four main facilitators? They're going to introduce individual segments. Now, the entire piece is on the military. There's so much violence. There are so many battles that really encompass the American Revolution. We think it was like, well, we signed the Declaration of Independence, it was over. It had begun the year before and it went on till 1783. And these were bloody battles, and they were fought on various continents. And so, yes, these are different battles. This is basically focusing on the military aspect, of which there is much in this series. And so, using Natalie, Dr. Krivas, to again talk a little bit about the battle, America invaded Canada. I had no idea that it happened. Again, I thought that was just now. But America actually invaded Canada and fought British forces there. And then at the end, with the signing of the peace treaty, what happened to the remaining expats? They were shipped up to various islands in the Caribbean, shipped back to Great Britain, and many, along with freed slaves, were sent to Nova Scotia. Well, Natalie Krivas is from Nova Scotia. She's got that edge. So again, we've got our British speaker who's going to introduce the Battle of Bunker's Hill, the Boston Massacre. And so we've got Richard Sevier showing who composed the Continental Army. A lot of people don't understand. These were not these moneyed white property owners. These were poor. These were slaves. In fact, you could put somebody else in your spot if there was the draft, and the draft did happen. So sub out. And so again, Richard Sevier is going to concentrate on that. And then James Old is going to begin the segment, two other battles, but he is going to come to the, he's going to basically cover the introduction of how did we get to these three branches of government and why is that important today? So each one of them will be introducing a mini segment to each. The entire length of this particular segment we've been allocated is approximately 50 minutes long, and it's broken up into 8 to 10 minute segments. So
is there room for questions?
Yes. And so we've reserved at the end, once we're done showing this, then we will go into the audience. They're seating for 340 people at round tables. And so the facilitators, we will have question lists on the tables. They can begin the discussions. And then our full facilitators, including Larry and myself and Nancy and Megan, will come and, around the tables and, again, make sure that conversation is flowing and to be that precipitating rod to make sure that if they don't understand some of the topics that were covered. So there should be, and there, like I said, there'll be refreshments for 2 hours. And so I think it's going to go very, very quickly. I teach a 4-hour class every Tuesday night. It's amazing how quickly that goes. So two hours with 8 people and 340 participants or audience members. This should be rather lively.
Well, we have just about a minute left. Let's recap how people can find out about the event, where they can go, websites and things like that for the April 22nd event.
Sure. Go to Lakeshore Public Media and you will see, again, there's a QR code that gives you more details. You can register through Lakeshore. You can register through contacting me, elizabeth.gingrich@valpo.edu. But reserve your place and please do this early. You can do this for a guest. If you have students, if you have clients, let me know. We'll see what we can accommodate. This is the end of April for this event. They'll go quickly.
Exactly. Well, I appreciate you coming on Art of the Air and sharing about the event, which, of course, I will be involved with. American Revolution is at Valpo University, April 22nd. You can go online, lakeshorepublicmedia.org. There's a code there and to register. Elizabeth Gingrich, thank you so much for coming on Art of the Air and sharing about the event.
Thank all of you, too.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much.
Certainly.
Art on the Air Spotlight and the complete one-hour program on Sunday is brought to you by Emberforge Consulting. With end-to-end expertise in learning strategy, design, and implementation, Emberforge turns your organization's knowledge into impact. To learn more, visit emberforgeconsulting.com. And as a reminder, if you'd like to have your event on Art on the Air Spotlight or have a longer feature interview, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com.
This is Peter Marks, former theater critic of the Washington Post, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
We are pleased to welcome Scott Christian Sava to Art on the Air. Scott is an artist, animator, and writer whose work over the past 30 years has brought beloved characters like Spider-Man, Casper, and the Power Rangers to life. He has collaborated with Marvel, Disney, and Nickelodeon. and is the founder of Blue Dream Studios, which created Animal Crackers, the number one animated film on Netflix in the summer of 2020. Today, he shares thoughts on art, autism, and kindness with over 4 million followers online. His new book, Becoming an Artist, is now available. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Scott. It is a pleasure meeting you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's nice to meet you too.
And I was always caught your published your book some time ago on Facebook, and they thought this would be a perfect guest for our show. But our people always want to know about your background story. I call it your origin story. Tell us how you got from where you were to where you are now.
I was maybe 6 or 7, and I discovered Spider-Man. I loved the old TV show back in the, well, for me, it was the 60s and 70s. And I discovered the comic book, and I started copying the comic book. And I decided sometime before I was 10 years old that I wanted to be the artist on Spider-Man. And for the next 20 years, I pursued that. And along the way, I got an internship at Sega of America doing video games. I learned 16-bit animation. I went into game design at Atari. I was an art director. I became a producer. I did covers for comics. I became an animator for TV and film and did not get that job doing Spider-Man. Every year, I would get rejected until I was, I think, 32 years old. And I finally got the gig, and I did it. And I think at that point, I had achieved my life's greatest goal, my singular focus. And then it was, now what? And since then, we had kids, we had twins, and I started writing books for them. I started writing children's books. And one of them turned into Animal Crackers, which became a movie that came out in 2020. And then we hit COVID. And then during COVID, it was what now again? And I went back to art, and I started posting my art online on TikTok and then YouTube. And next thing I know, I have 4 million followers, and I get a call from Hay House, who says, would you like to take all of this art stuff that you're talking about and put it into a book? And I think that brings me up to where we are today.
Oh, but we want to know about childhood. So I read that you actually grew up in a household filled with artists, including, like, I loved learning about Uncle Ray, because I had that same experience where you walk into somebody's studio, you know, and you're just small, and it's just
art
so
studios
magnificent.
Are magical. Yeah, there's all of this wonder and mystery. It's almost like an apothecary, you know. There's all of these paints and brushes and hidden drawers and concoctions and sometimes skulls and things like that. Yeah. My Uncle Ray was in Westchester, New York, and we had moved to Florida, but we would go back to New York in the summers, and so I would get to see him then. And but my mom and her brother, my Uncle Ray, were both artists. And then their uncle, our Uncle Dave, was also an artist. And so it was kind of encouraged. Whereas I know a lot of families, unfortunately, these young artists, they're told, no, you're not going to make any money. You can't survive. You got to be a doctor or a lawyer or an engineer or an accountant or something. And I feel you don't know how blessed you are until you see how your family encouraged you and was there for you to get you through art school and, you know, and all of the stuff that happened to get you where you are. And that was when when my publisher asked me to do an acknowledgments at the end of the book. And I said, well, what is that? And they said, well, that's where you thank people. I said, oh, I already did that at the beginning. I thanked my mom and my wife and my kids. And no, this is more like, all the people who got you, who made this book happen. And that turned into, I think, 4 or 5 pages, because it takes a village. There's so many people in my life, from my high school art teacher to, you know, friends who encouraged me, to family who supported me when money wasn't, you know, flowing, because that's the life of an artist. It takes a village to have an artist in the family. And
so how were you supported in actually school? What was elementary school like? Was your talent evident to the teachers?
I don't think it was until junior high. I think up until seventh grade, it was an annoyance because I was not paying attention. You know, I was also undiagnosed autistic. I didn't know I was autistic until I was 53. And so when I look back on the complications I had as a student and me retreating to art in loud and overstimulating situations, the teachers didn't know either. And so it was more getting reprimanded, getting sent to the principal's office a lot. It wasn't until junior high where it became a superpower, the art, not the autism, but this became a superpower to where people went, oh, that's really nice. And people started taking notice.
So you're moving on in your career, and we already touched on some of it because you jumped ahead. But one of the things that struck me is that, and you just mentioned it about, you know, making a decision to make money versus art, but you also address in your book, you can still be an artist and still be doing something else. So, and so you don't have to embrace that, oh, this is the only thing I want to do. And I think both Esther and I have friends that are very much like that. There are active artists that have done other things. So, but tell us about that in your book, people and experiences you have with people like that.
Yeah, I've found that I had no other skills. I had nothing else to rely on. When I was doing video games, it paid well. I had a 401k and health insurance, but I was still painting it at nights. And I didn't know because I was too young to realize it, but that was I was still doing something creative during the day. And then I was doing the art that I wanted to at night. But I think there's just this misconception with artists saying that I'm an artist, and so therefore that's all I can do. And everybody's an artist if you make art. So an accountant is an artist, and a teacher is an artist, and a bus driver is an artist. Yeah. You just need to want to make art. And it doesn't have to be drawing or painting. It could be music. It could be dance. It could be singing. It could be poetry. It could be writing a novel. I've got a friend who's my friend Ron, who built the Hobbit Hole I'm in right now. He's a contractor, and I think he said he is 70,000 words into his first novel. He does contracting. He builds homes and buildings during the day. And then whenever he can, he sneaks away and he writes a little bit of his book. And I think he is no less of a writer, of an artist, than anybody who's doing it full time. It has nothing to do with your day job. It just has to do with whether you're making art. That's the only requirement to be called an artist is, do I make art? And that's it.
Yeah, and tell us a little bit about your gaming career, and that even though that was a job, there's a great deal of creativity. I mean, just what you said, there's an art to it, even though you pursued your own art afterward. But tell us how you got into that, how some of the things that you did with those.
Yeah, I mean, I started off in 16-bit, which if you don't know, it's kind of like drawing with Legos. You have these 16 pixels is all you get. And I think it was maybe 4 to 8 colors. And because memory was very limited back in the late 80s, early 90s. And I learned as the industry grew, as technology grew, I got to work in bigger and better stuff. I got into 3D animation. I was a game designer. I got to do some really, really fun stuff that, like I said, unfortunately, I didn't appreciate because I was so singularly focused on Spider-Man. But I got to learn how to animate. I got to learn how to design. I got to learn how to be a producer and art director. I was given all of these wonderful opportunities from these companies because it came naturally to me. It came easily to me. And the industry wasn't set up, the gaming industry wasn't set up for artists. Artists in the 80s were still pencil and paper, paint brushes. They weren't computers. And so the fact that I was able to take to computing and software so quickly just gave me a leg up for a while. And that was really good up until about maybe 2005, and then school started to teach animation and computers and whatnot. But for a good 15 years. It was just because I was able to pick up the computer, really, is all it was.
So while you were, like, I think Atari was one of the companies, right? Yeah. So while you were working at these companies, did you have a personal practice at home away from that still? Or was that sort of on hold while you were, all your energy was toward?
Yeah, no, I was actually getting work doing illustration because I was an illustration major. I was at Atari, I think, from 92 to 95. And during that time, I was doing work. I remember I was doing some advertising work for Kool-Aid. I think I worked on the Pink Swamingo flavor for some ad agency. And I was doing covers for magazines and books and whatnot, whatever I could get from San Jose, California at night, you know? So it was a lot of trying to network without the internet. Everything was fax machines and letters and flying out to New York when you could. And I was getting work. And I think what happened was I finally got some of my art noticed by a company called Malibu Comics out in Southern California that was doing Star Trek comics. And they said, can you do Deep Space Nine? We've got the rights to Deep Space. So I did a bunch of covers for them, and that turned into them making me an offer to leave Atari and to come down and work there. And that kind of got me out to LA, where I started to meet more people. But I've always done freelance work. I was actually a member of the New York Society of Illustrators for a period of time, which was a huge thing for me and my uncle, who was also a member. He was my sponsor when they said, do you have anybody who could sponsor you? And so it was a really big deal. But illustration, once Photoshop became a mainstay, movie posters kind of went away, and advertising and a lot of that stuff kind of went away with the advent of designers being able to do the job that illustrators used to be able to do.
You know, with the AI thing, you're talking about Photoshop and whole suite. What do you think, and it's hard to predict the future, the impact of AI coming on the scene now with illustration and other things? And, I know I played around with it just for fun, doing stuff with like myself at a microphone or something. But I mean, that's got to have a scary impact for everyone now.
Oh, yeah. I have very big feelings about it.
Okay. Well, tell us.
I played around with it too when it first came out. I thought that the tech bros, as I call them, that created AI did it wrong. They could have had it be a help to artists. It could have been, you could have gone to your chat bot and said, show me Back to the Future as told by Gustav Klimt. Give me something where you just throw a couple of ideas just as a visual board to get your mind going in a direction. You know, I'd like to do the Princess Bride in the Pre-Raphaelite kind of style. Can you give me something like that? Would be wonderful. And then that gets me in a direction where I go, okay. And then I go and I make art. Right. Musicians, it could have been, give me Michael Jackson's Thriller in 1920s jazz style or something, and get your mind going. Now I'm going to go make music. Writing, you could have done it. You could have done it for all sorts of creative endeavors, but instead they said, no, we're just going to have it make it without the artists. And we're going to use the artist's work.
Yeah.
We're going to steal from them. So you're stealing the music, the writing, the art, and then you're just saying, we don't need you artists. And that's really, I think they could have done it in a way there where artists would have said, this is wonderful. This is a wonderful visual tool or audio tool that I could use.
It could have been complimentary.
It could have been, but instead they said, no, we're going to steal from you and then we're going to take away your jobs.
Yeah.
And that's the only reason to do it. The only reason for AI. And I'd be happy to talk to anybody who has a differing opinion, but the only reason for AI is to replace humans. There's no other reason to make AI. Now, there are some health and science stuff where they're like, look, we can train this to do things that humans don't have the time or the capacity to do. Great. Right now, it's still wrong 50% of the time. So humans still have to go over the work and the data anyhow. It's wrong. ChatGPT is wrong almost all the time. You ask it stuff, and if you ever ask it about yourself, and almost always it's like, you know, you worked here. I never worked there. Oh, you're right. You never. Why would you say that? And it has no fact checking. It will not fact check. And I think so. Right now, there's no use for it. Again, I could do a whole show about AI, but there is no use for it. People aren't asking for it, but it's being thrown into our email and our text messaging and everything else and forced on us as if it's the next thing. But we didn't ask for it. And we don't use it. We don't have a need for it. They could have done it better. They could have done it, and we would have all supported it. They could have supported the arts instead of trying to replace it.
Yeah. That's a very strong point there. And of course, the big subject not related to art is how ChatGPT and how they're going to allow the Pentagon to use it without restriction. I think that's a very scary thing.
That's literally the entire movie of the Terminator.
Right.
Cyberdyne, they let Skynet handle the missiles and you know, yeah, it's insane that no one watched these movies.
So at what point did you decide you were going to write your book?
I didn't. I had nothing. Like, I planned to be the artist on Spider-Man. I did not plan on being an author. But that was all my editor, Allison. She called me and she convinced me. And really, Hay House made me feel important. They made me feel needed. They treated me with respect, and they flew me and my wife out to New York so I can go paint. And the entire way, they just were so encouraging, and it was very rare. I've always had, like I said, with Spider-Man, every year I would get rejected until I think begrudgingly after 15 years of being rejected, they gave me a little 4-issue miniseries. I feel like my entire life, everything I've had to fight for. This was the first time I didn't believed in us.
Don't you think the Spider-Man came because you adjusted your dream of what that meant to do Spider-Man? Didn't?
I think it could never come. I think just because you dream something hard enough doesn't mean it's ever going to happen.
No, I know. But you it, rather than how you first envisioned you were going to work on Spider-Man, didn't you have to do it like in a 3D sort of?
Yeah, and that was my friend Marv's idea to try taking my day job in animation and applying it to comic books. And that combination was unique enough to get me that job. You're right. The way that Hay House treated me and continues to treat me has been such an amazing experience. And mm-hmm. and I wish every creative person gets to experience that at least once in their life, to where somebody values and loves you and cares about your work enough to support it. It's been a wonderful experience.
I wanted to, you know, in reading the book, of course, there's a lot of practice, and with anything, practice. But there was a sentence in the book that I just really enjoyed, which was, you got most of the bad art out of you by all that practice. So it's just such a marvelous sentence.
I think it dawned on me maybe 4 years ago, for the first time in my life, I was making more good art than bad art. I had always just... It was in my brain since making art since I was 7 years old that I was now 52, 53 years old, and I didn't hate, I wasn't worried I might hate this. I was actually at this point where I was going, this will probably come out okay. I've got a rhythm down. And and that's when that chapter kind of came around. Was
the corner of shame. That was another thing.
Yeah. The corner of shame. But you know, I think the point of becoming an artist and my videos in general was to show the unglamorous side of being an artist, the human side of being an artist, that we make mistakes. We make a lot of mistakes, that we don't like our art, that we have imposter syndrome, and we are always worried that we're not going to be as good as our idols, that we're scared of using our good art materials. All of the things that were never taught to us in art school. And I think that is a healthy conversation to have. And it's really kind of connected with a lot of people around the world, is I'm not showing my best work. I'm mm-hmm. showing myself ripping up my art. I'm showing myself saying I didn't like how this came out. I'm showing myself making mistakes. I'm not hiding the mistakes. I'm showing that I'm making mistakes, because I think there's just always this perception that true artists don't make mistakes. True artists make perfect work. They never have a bad day. I just wanted to dispel that.
So have long fallow periods as well, you know?
Yeah. I had 10 years after I did Spider-Man, I had 10 years where I didn't touch a painting. I didn't draw. And I just was tired of that style that I'd been doing since I was maybe in high school. And that's when I came back in my 40s, picked up watercolors, studied Alphonse Mucha's Art Nouveau style, and just went off into a different direction. It's been wonderful, but sometimes we need to take time off.
I know in photography, they similar thing. They say the first 10,000 images you have are pretty well junk, and you really do that. And while you might get one here, one here that's a hit, you have to really learn, in that case, the technique and everything. Unfortunately, we're in our last minute here, and I want to give you a chance to tell people how they can find your book and your website and anything else about you.
Oh, thank you. The book, Becoming an Artist, is available worldwide in any bookstore, and you can find me pretty much anywhere at S. Sava Art. That's S for Scott, Sava Art, on YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, Threads, wherever you want to find me. And I'd be happy to talk to you.
Fantastic. Well, Scott, this was an excellent conversation. There were so many more questions. I think either one of us would want to talk about your Animal Crackers movie and how you got into that. Yeah. But then maybe we'll do a visit somewhere down the road again.
And, I'd love to.
And everything. Our guest today was Scott Krishnasava, Becoming an Artist. And it's an easy read. It's short chapters, which I love short chapters. And really kind of reveals a lot about you and your process. But also, I think I was going to ask you a question, but I think for a budding artist or someone interested in doing this, even not full time, it'd be a great book for them to pick up and do that. And I love the cover, by the way. I think that's
thank you.
So thank you so much for coming on Art in the Air and sharing your arts journey.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I really enjoyed the book.
Art in the Air listeners, do you have a suggestion for a possible guest on our show? Whether it's an artist, musician, author, gallery, theater, concert, or some other artistic endeavor that you are aware of, or a topic of interest to our listeners, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com.
This is author Christopher Grayson, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP 103.1 FM.
We are happy to welcome Zachary Mark to Art on the Air. Zachary is a playwright with 3 full stage plays, short works, and a membership with the Dramatists Guild of America. He is also the chief of Center Township Fire Department in South Bend. From a young age, theater was part of his family life. Frequenting the Canterbury Summer Theater, he was drawn into the entirety of the whole experience. His play, Second Glance, had its U.S. premiere at the Holdcraft Players in Michigan City. It was his first play, and he completed it in 2018, and that play has subsequently been performed globally. Zachary also earned a fully funded residency at the 100th Hill in Bloomington, Indiana recently. Steve Scott of Dunes Arts Foundation, where he is the producing artistic director there, will direct Second Glance. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air, Zachary. Aloha and welcome. It is wonderful meeting you.
Nice meeting you. Thanks for having me.
Well, Zachary, we always like to start off our show with our guest's origin story. And I teed up by saying how you got from where you were to where you are now. You tell us all about yourself.
Sure. Born and raised in Michigan City. Went to a small Catholic high school there, Marquette. We had about 220 in the school when I was there. After that, went to Ball State University, majored in telecommunications, and I minored in theater. I wanted to go into TV or film, I thought at that point. But after I graduated, I went into broadcast TV in South Bend. Worked for CBS out of there, WSBT, was a news videographer for the morning show. So I'd go out and shoot the news, come back, edit it. I got to do some fun stories in the morning show too, which was great. And then I also went into commercial work, started to write and produce and direct commercials for WSJB, Fox 28. And it was about during that time that I was looking for a career shift. So I started looking around, and I was kind of drawn to the firefighter profession. But I wanted to make sure this was a good move instead of just ripping up my degree from Ball State and going somewhere else. But so I volunteered, became a volunteer firefighter. And it wasn't about a year into it, I knew that's where I wanted to go. So I became a full-time firefighter, and I've been writing on the side for quite a few years. And just recently is when I'm starting to get some work out there, get it published and now produced, and trying to keep the ball rolling.
So you had, you know, you had mentioned that there was a lot of theater in your young age. What was happening in the schools with you, though, in the arts? Where, what was available to you there? And were you writing? I mean, were you interested in writing at that point?
Yeah, I was always writing screenplays or short skits. I always loved Saturday Night Live growing up. So I do those things on the side. But as far as the arts at the high school, there's kind of this 10-15 year gap in Marquette history where there was no performing arts. Unfortunately, that's when I was there. Mm-hmm. So I really didn't get into the theater aspect until college, which I loved. I wish I would have had it in high school. They do now. They have a program that's great. So glad to see that.
I know, in the Canterbury Summer Theater, all these theater programs have so many opportunities for all ages now. Mm-hmm. I know.
We loved going to the Canterbury Theater, seeing the kids. To me, they were Broadway stars, but back, you know, back then. But obviously, summer stock, they were in college. And yeah, really loved to watch shows there.
You know, the quality is excellent.
Mm-hmm. Did you do any performing along the way? I mean, was that part of the mix, or was it always writing or behind the scenes or things like that?
In the audience?
Yeah, just writing. I had a counselor in college. I had a film minor, and he said, well, what do you want to do? I said, you know, I'd like to direct, or, you know. He says, well, you need to know where the actors come from. I think you need to switch to a theater minor instead of film. And he was right. And so I got to do a little bit of acting in class, but yeah, it's I would love to be an actor. I don't understand how they memorize all the lines, and they're really great at what they do, and I'll stick to just writing.
In your firefighting career, has that informed any of your work in writing? I mean, you've written some other things, not your current piece. It's that was just performed at the Holdcraft, but has that been part of it yet?
How firefighting fits in as far as storylines?
Right.
Possibly. Yeah, I see a lot. Unfortunately, it's one of the worst days of people's lives for the most part. But when you're invited into their house and you're trying to care for their loved ones, you know, we may be waiting on an ambulance, just kind of look around and I look at the pictures and see what kind of family they had and kind of piece together, I guess, a story, that I could use. But yeah, there's a lot of stories there with, being a firefighter.
So tell us a little bit about your current production that was at Holdcraft, and a little bit about the storyline and characters and even the evolution, how you brought that to bear.
Sure. Second glance, it's about a young man named Sam who leaves his hometown, Michigan City, goes out to New York to become a writer. He gets rejected numerous times, but finally gets an offer from a publisher. And it's a story about his estranged grandfather and him growing up. Growing up with his grandfather as one of his best friends who he hasn't talked to in 15 plus years. The publisher wants him to go back to his hometown, get more insight from his grandfather about the events that happened that made the family kind of tear apart. So Sam reluctantly agrees and heads back to Michigan City to talk to his estranged grandfather and find out some personal things, and he's got to kind of skate around that, as well as his mother and ex-girlfriend. So there's a lot, obviously, when you go back to your hometown, you have to answer to some things maybe you left unanswered when he left. So explores that. I started to write this, I think it was late 90s. And then, like I said, life kind of happens, and I didn't revisit it until about 2016-ish. There was a plot point I wasn't too happy with, and I just moved on to some of the other things. But my girlfriend, then fiance, then wife, through those years, would bring it up every now and then, like, are you ever going to finish that play? And so I finally decided, you know what, I'm gonna try it. And I finished it. Once I got past that plot point, that was kind of, I was stuck at. It took maybe 3 months, and I had my script, and was pretty happy. And then I thought, hey, you know, I might as well send it out to some publishers, which I found out how difficult it is to find publishers with unsolicited offers. So I found Off the Wall Plays. They're out of London and South Africa. And they take submissions every year or two. And so I sent it to them, and it was maybe 8 months later, they said they'd like to publish it. And I thought, great, you know, whatever happens, happens. And then a couple years later is when it debuted in New Zealand. My wife had always said, wherever it lands, we'll go see it. I'm sure she was thinking Ohio, Illinois. She wasn't thinking New Zealand. So we did not make the trip to New Zealand. So that's why I was very pleased to eventually, you know, make it on the stage at Holdcraft in Michigan City. But right before that, we had a Voices from the Heartland, which is at the Dune Summer Theater, which Steve Scott put on. And so they did a stage reading of that. And right afterwards, Arturo Pozos from Holdcraft came up, said, we'd love to do the show. Steve said, you beat me to it, but I want to be a part of it. So he said he would direct it. And, you know, couple years later, here we are, and had a great run at the Holdcraft.
What a magic team, Arturo, Steve, and you and the community. That's excellent.
Yes.
So your other plays, I read that they're also locally based. Can you kind of talk about what the other plays' themes are?
Sure. Baby by Number is based on the true story of in October 1951, a baby was taken from St. Anthony's in Michigan City. I was looking for a topic for my next play, so I went to the public library website and just kind of went down the timeline of things that have happened in Michigan City. And I had never heard of that. And my grandparents grew up in Michigan City, my great grandparents, and I was surprised that I had never heard of this story. So I delved into that, and it's a really tragic story, but one that I wanted to write and I'm proud of. So I'm trying to find a home for that one. And another one that's based in Michigan City is the Trails Creek. And that's based, I had a severely mentally handicapped aunt growing up, and my grandparents, you know, took care of her, and she was in a school, which is now the Social and Learning Institute in Michigan City. And that kind of started in my grandparents' garage, because kids with the special needs, after they get to a certain age through school, there's nothing left for them. So they started that school. So I wrote a story based around that. So yeah, I have three of the full length are Michigan City. The next couple are not, but I'm glad to, I'm proud of the three in Michigan City, and hopefully they all get to play in Michigan City at some point.
Oh, I hope so as well. So can you talk about your residency at the 100th Hill? What did you accomplish there, and how did it come about?
It was great. I just looking online for residencies and then found that one in Bloomington. And I thought, I was kind of worried to go there and just, you're focused on writing, you should be writing. I thought I'd feel the pressure. But once I got there, it was amazing. I was just... they kind of leave you alone. If you want to talk to other writers, you could, but I just kind of stayed in this Airstream in the woods, and had my record player going, and it was great. And I didn't write too much the past 6 months, but I got there and I had a pretty good outline of my next one and started to write the dialogue. So it was amazing.
Wow, that's so exciting.
You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
So do you have anything down the pike that you're working on? You gave us some of them, but and do you write anything outside of doing plays? I mean, do you write like novels, short stories, and things like that? Is that still in your bailiwick?
No, I haven't. I've just kind of stuck with I'll have a couple of full-length plays going, and then I usually have two or three 10-minute plays on the side, so if I ever get stuck, there's something I can go to. It's just, I'm not going to write today. There's something I can write, so I try to keep busy that way.
Well, tell us about your writing process, and especially, I know dialogue, because that's what really plays are, that and stage directions, which are different. Tell us about your process and working out that, and how do you get that? And kind of an adjunct to that is, how do you get the speaking and the dialogue natural for the different characters?
First of all, I try to have brainstorming sessions and sit on the back porch, have a cigar, and see what comes of it. And then I really outline my plays, and that could take months of just the different beats and what I want to accomplish with each one. And then the dialogue just really comes easy for me, since I've done so much outlining. I know which direction they're going to go. And sometimes it's easy if you kind of cast your play with famous people or people you know. I think the way their movement or their dialect can really help you get through the dialogue process.
Well, and since you have production experience, again, in television, but the theater minor, would you ever want to direct one of your own plays? I mean, especially one that, well, like your current one is kind of now established a little bit. Would you like to take a crack at actually staging it yourself?
Yeah, well, wouldn't mind directing any of my plays, but to have Steve Scott, I'd well, rather go with him than me. But Steve was great throughout the whole process. I was at every rehearsal, and the way he connected with each actor, delving deeper and deeper into the background of each character. I learned a lot by just sitting and being in the room with Steve.
Yeah, I just think of that triumvirate. So powerful.
Are you marketing your current show elsewhere? I mean, you're trying to get it out so other companies pick it up and do it.
Yeah, I'm trying to let as many theater makers in the area and try to get out regionally. Obviously, the greatest thing would be, you know, try to get into the Chicago market, but we'll take it a step at a time. And I'm really happy with the play. I'm really happy with the way it turned out. And hopefully that kind of opens up doors for people to let me do some more work in this area.
Yeah, that would be fantastic. Hopefully Steve can possibly be a little bridge to Chicago. Yeah.
Yes, yes. And he has expressed interest in Baby by Number. So we'll see what shakes from that. Yeah,
maybe even can pick that up at Dunes, though I know that there's a little more of a commercial thing that they have to do there, but that might be kind of a great launching pad for your production and your second one and everything.
What about reaching out to the Canterbury Summer Theater?
Well, yeah.
I have, and they're more or less, I would have to self-produce it, and with my job and everything else, I can't self-produce that right now, but I would love to, yeah.
So, you touched on it a little bit about having the cigar on the back porch, working on it, but tell us about like your process a little bit in terms of, you know, in terms of writing, but where do you get the stories? They seem like they're all origin story, you know, original stories from like Michigan City and thing, but how do you like pull together what your topics are going to be?
Just kind of the good ones stick with you. I know everybody says, you know, have a pad of paper around, and I get that to a point, but I think the good ideas just stick with you and they won't leave you alone. So I come up with numerous ideas, and if one just keeps on knocking at the door, that's the one that I kind of focus on or drawn to. And those first three full-length plays, obviously I was drawn to because I had personal attachment to. And I just try to write and try to write things that I would love to see on the theater, on the stage.
Does it come easy, do you think? Like let's take Second Glance. Yeah. Maybe not that one, because that one was, you know, you had that block and then all of a sudden it broke through, which I believe every single artist goes through. There's some things that you just need to leave aside even decades before you figure out what the next step is. So maybe a different one. Is the dialogue, do you see it right from the start? Like when you think of an idea and it's sticking with you, are you able to, is it a struggle to get it to go on, or do you see kind of the whole great big picture?
Try to see the whole play. Yeah. And that's why I try to outline to make sure that I have a whole play, that it makes sense. And it's
like being a firefighter, huh? You have to assess right away and make really quick decisions. Right. And it sounds like that's very much informs your playwriting as well. You know, you have that really clear vision and know what you have to do. You know, you assess quickly.
Exactly. And that's kind of difficult translating in the theater, because, you know, once I got that first play published, it's like, okay, let's go, you know, quickly. And anything in theater, it just takes years, and it's that long, drawn out thing. So I'm not used to that. So I'm trying to be better at accepting that. But yeah, with firefighting, it's very quick decisions. And maybe that's why I like writing. I get to sit down, just relax, and think things through.
Sounds like the residency was a true... Yeah. A holiday almost. I mean, you were really like this airstream in the woods. You know, you can't take that call, you know.
Right. Don't have to let out the dog and talk about what's for dinner. So it was, I'm very grateful for that opportunity. It was really great.
So this may be looking down the road in a few years. Obviously, you're not probably going to stay a firefighter for the rest of your life. There's going to be a retirement. Do you think then you'll have time to really pursue, you know, new works, building a body of work that you can kind of push out there even more? I mean, it's got to be difficult balance to do that, to really push your work out while you have a full-time job.
Right. And with three kids, too, I have one kid. My youngest is a junior in high school, so I think we're a couple years away from being empty nesters, and don't think I'm going to be looking around for things to do. I know exactly what I want to do, and like you said, there'd be some more writing and maybe some more aggressiveness on my end of getting more things out.
What about acting? Do you think you'll act in one of your plays? Steve occasionally will give himself a little walk-on yeah. things that he's doing.
Yeah. I wouldn't mind a little Alfred Hitchcock cameo, but other than that, we'll see.
Tell us a little bit about advice you would give to someone, and again, that wants to do playwriting. I know we've talked about your process, but tell them, like, well, here, you know, this, and I realize it might be different for everyone, but what advice would you give someone? Gee, I would really like to write a play, you know.
Don't be afraid to do bad work. I mean, you just have to write. And sit down, and it's not a job and you're supposed to enjoy it, but at some point you have to sit down and kind of force yourself to at least do a little bit each day, maybe a half hour. You don't have to write a whole play in one day, or just give yourself a half hour and just build from that. But you kind of have to play the fool. And sometimes when you sit down, you want to write the next greatest world premiere that everybody's looking for. Just kind of start small, maybe do a 10-minute play. And then build from that. But yeah, you just don't be afraid and don't listen to anybody else. Make what you want to make and do your best.
I'd be kind of amazed if anything happened really on that first draft. Everything is like, you got to get it down first, but then everything happens in the rewrite and the refining.
Yeah, and don't be so defensive. Everybody's trying to help you out, but yeah. You'll get there.
And then with a new play, it becomes sometimes a directing process. You know, you bring a play that's kind of raw, and they sometimes retool a little bit in that whole thing. And, you know, that's that's how professional theater is done. One quick question. I know we're getting close to the end here, but I wanted to say, have you ever thought of moving out of a genre just to play and maybe doing that, writing like the book for a musical, or is that anywhere in your world?
Yeah, I'd be up for that. I love musicals. That's an option. I think, actually Second Glance, at one point I was thinking about, could this be a musical? But I think I was biting off more than I could chew with that, with my first one, But yeah, I'm always kind of thinking of, you know, if it makes sense to be a musical, then yeah, I'd probably go that route and write that book.
And musicals have changed from narrative form to other things, like we have more and even sometimes very unstructured anymore. So you're kind of free to create. You know, you look at a product musical like Hamilton, which is completely, you know, kind of has a story, but really gone away into a concept mode and everything. Well, in our last minute here, tell us anything about how people can find out about you, your work, and, you know, things like that.
Sure. Website is ZacharyMark.org. I'm also on Facebook. Search Zachary Mark, Indiana Playwright. I'm on there. Those are probably the two best places to go. I'm not too much on the X or Twitter or whatever it is this week. So that's probably your best route.
Well, we appreciate you coming on Art in the Air, sharing your wonderful story about your production. Zachary Mark, and he just had his production running at the Holdcraft Theater. It was very successful. Thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your writing journey.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art in the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Art on the Air is also heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell it to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode. Our spotlight interviews are heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Media. Thanks to Dee Dotson, Vice President of Radio Operations for Lakeshore Public Media, and to Greg Kovach, WVLP's Station Manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. We'd like to thank our current underwriters for Lakeshore Public Media, Ember Forge Consulting, thoughtful marketing and digital learning built to express your purpose and grow your reach. Learn more at emberforgeconsulting.com/grow. And for WVLP, Walt Breidinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art in the Air, we rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art in the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. You'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or send us information about your arts, arts-related event, or exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck, BRECH.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the Air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the Air, our way. Express yourself through show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.